And so when I think about the spring, I think about, you know, the history of the Dakota people. But not only the Dakota, but, you know, many, many tribes travel through this area. And there are many sacred sites along the Mississippi here.
I've got 26 years into this, studying this site. And I studied the history of it. And I started the preservation on it. And one of the things is that what I started this for was to build a, get a park made for everybody, get it preserved for everybody.
Oh, what does Coldwater Spring mean to me? I have been working on this since day one when I came to the Park Service 11 years ago. And it's a place of probably the deepest history, in the continuous history in the state.
Just south of Minnehaha Park, past a set of locked gates on the former Bureau of Mines campus, exists a spring that, some say, has existed for over 10,000 years. At one time, it provided drinking water for the city of Minneapolis during a drought in the 1970s. Soldiers camped there while building Fort Snelling. And to some, the spring and the water is a sacred site that is home to a powerful underworld god who travels through the flow and down to the Mississippi River. It's called Minneoesne, or Coldwater Spring.
So when you use the phrase the birthplace of Minnesota, it does have a double meaning, that it may be the birthplace for white settlement because of those people of European ancestry who lived around Fort Snelling and at the spring. And this was before, really before there was a town of Mendota, and before there was a town of Stillwater, and before there was a city of St. Paul, all the, you know, various places that consider themselves to be the birthplace of Minnesota at various times. But there still is this much older history of this area being the birthplace for the Dakota people, which goes back thousands of years.
We believe that there's spirits that go through the water from Coldwater Spring to the rivers. Onktehi is the water spirit and would go into the underground underneath Tekuwakan Teepee. So we're in that vicinity. There's many, many sacred sites and along the whole river to St. Paul and both ways, village sites and everything else.
There may have been deep, long stories of this place, but they've been lost because the people who had them died before they could pass them on due to a smallpox epidemic or a measles epidemic or, you know, a war between the Ojibwe and the Dakota, or, you know, forced basically by American expansion and the fur trade. So how do we capture these stories? And what I've told people too, and has made some upset, is I'm worried about something here from the story aspect. That was a tragedy to lose those stories. Now, making up false stories of a place would be just as tragic. If the story of this place isn't true and it's being used for political reasons and it's being made up to fit a political situation and other reasons, I see that as bad as the other end of the spectrum, as having it taken away. Because what you want is the true history of a people in a place and true stories of a place. And the documentation just hasn't supported the story of this place very well yet.
To all who have known about or visited Coldwater Spring, there is one thing everyone agrees upon. The flow of the water must not be harmed in any way. There was legislation passed in 2002 that states just that after the controversial Highway 55 reroute. Protecting the flow of water is the point at which many people, including the National Park Service, members of the Mendota, Madewakantuan, Dakota, historians, activists, pagans, and your average visitor part ways. The issue at hand is whether this site is a sacred site, and therefore should enjoy federal protection under the National Register of Historic Places. No one denies its special place in history. On a recent bone-chilling Saturday afternoon, John Anfinson, the Chief of Cultural Resource Management at the National Park Service, led curious visitors on a tour. As we stood yards away from the old spring house, he explained part of its history.
We begin history here in 1820 with
kind of the birthplace of Minnesota, the frontier fort being here, the Dakota and the Ojibwa coming to visit the fort is a major center of American activity in the region at this time. So 1820s, you'd have found Dakota camped here or Ojibwa camped here, visiting the fort, interacting, maybe getting stuff fixed at the blacksmith shops. And all the way up to the 1990s, this place is a place of significant national stories going on. So it's a pretty phenomenal site for history of Minnesota.
To some, yes, this place can be considered the birthplace of Minnesota. Its significance in westward expansion makes it such. But for others, like the Mendota Madewakantuan, it's the birthplace for another reason.
Omitakuyasin, Dakota ia makpia duta amakiapido, wasichu ia Jim Anderson amakiapido. What I just said in Dakota is hello, my relatives. My Dakota name is Makpia Duta, or Red Sky, and my Wasichu, or white name, is Jim Anderson. I'm currently the tribal chairman of the Mendota Badewakantuan Dakota Oyate, or the Mendota Dakota community in English. This was the site of the first Dakota village when the Creator put us there. This was the first fire, was by a Coldwater Spring. That was the source for the village. And I've got a stone axe head that they date at least 7,000 years old, so our people have been here for a long, long time. This spring has been flowing for at least 10,000 years, and I'm not a geologist, and those guys guess a lot anyway. I think it's been flowing since the beginning of time here, and that's a long time ago. First medicine is water. You can go without eating and other things for quite a while, but you can't go without water. And if you don't have that water, you die. So this was a source, like I said, on their own historical plaque, they had that the people building the fort got sick. They came up here and they got their health and wellness back. They don't mention anything about the Dakotas showing them where it was or anything. But that again, you know, the conquerors write the history. And
the area surrounding Mini-Oesni, or Coldwater Spring, is considered by the Dakota to be the genesis of their culture. It flows just a few miles upriver from Fort Snelling at an estimated 80,000 gallons per day. The area is known as the Confluence, the place where both the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers meet. The Dakota call it Bedote. It's difficult to say how long the spring has been flowing, but archaeologists and researchers say at least 11,000 to 12,000 years, if not more. There have been prehistoric archaeological artifacts, most notably a ground stone tool dating back to 800 BC found there. The oldest find, a spear point, was discovered at the Sibley House, which was believed to be 8,000 to 10,000 years old. Both Pat Emerson, head of archaeology at the Minnesota Historical Society, and anthropologist and historian Bruce White are familiar with the history of Coldwater Spring.
It has to be that Native people were living in the area. It just has to be. We do have very solid archaeological evidence of American Indian people living in this area going back 8,000 or 10,000 years. In Fort Snelling State Park, there are a number of known archaeological sites. Across the river from us at the Sibley House, there are archaeological deposits that go back probably at least 8,000 years. Mm-hmm. So American Indian people have a very, very long presence in the river valley.
Mm-hmm. Speaking purely from historical documents, written records, which is not the only source of information about Coldwater Spring. The first record of the importance of this area, this particular area that includes the spring, as a place of importance to the Dakota, the first record of that is in 1720, when there's an account by a Frenchman who recorded that the Dakota people believed that the first man and woman came out of the ground in this area between the mouth of the Minnesota River and St. Anthony Falls on the prairie of Minneapolis, or within that area. So at Coldwater Spring specifically as being a place of genesis for the Dakota.
Yeah, the whole area around the confluence and up both rivers has a lot of evidence of Native habitation. Would have been a very advantageous place to live because the rivers are major travel corridors. So people could travel long distances up and down the Mississippi River, up and down the Minnesota. It could have been a sort of a common gathering spot for people from great distances away.
The spring has a long and eventful history in the westward expansion of the United States, besides its prehistoric claims. Under a treaty signed in 1805 by the Dakota and Zebulon Pike, the U.S. military was allowed to use the surrounding area to build a fort. In exchange, the Dakota were promised continued use of that land. It was decided that Fort Snelling would be built on the bluff overlooking the confluence area. In the Minnesota River Valley at that time, many soldiers fell ill after drinking contaminated water. They needed a reliable source of fresh drinking water while they built the fort. In 1820, soldiers moved up from the Minnesota River Valley to what became known as Camp Coldwater. The camp became a bustling center of trade, business, and a gathering place for the Dakota and Ojibwe, as well as the white settlers. Again, Pat Emerson and Bruce White.
At about the same time, other Euro-American settlers started arriving and settled in the area where the soldiers were camping, and it became a little settlement of essentially civilians who interacted with the soldiers at the fort. A lot of these people came from Canada.
So in the spring, they moved up to, and they erected barracks at Coldwater Spring. So the first soldiers lived at Coldwater Spring over beginning that summer. And that's also when the first Indian agency was established there. And the Indian agent brought together Dakota and Ojibwe groups. He was kind of a mediator between them, and he brought them together at Coldwater Spring. His name was Lawrence Tolliver. He was Indian agent from 1821 until 39. In the years following, Ojibwe came to Fort Snelling every year, and one of their purposes in coming was to meet with the Dakota. And the Ojibwe would camp at Coldwater Spring, the Dakota would camp in the areas around and would come and visit with them. They danced, they had ceremony, they traded birch bark canoes and maple sugar and wild rice.
Camp Coldwater is thought to be the first civilian settlement in Minnesota, but it was also considered part of the military base. As such, civilians were not allowed to live there. It was tolerated until the late 1830s when a change in command happened at Fort Snelling. Non-military personnel were promptly emptied out of the camp. Pat Emerson explains.
So most people left Camp Coldwater, and what a lot of them did was simply go a little further downriver on the Mississippi, and they founded what eventually became St. Paul.
In the late 1800s, up until the 20th century, it's unclear what went on at Coldwater Spring. Traders continued to live there through the 1840s until most people were ejected out of the camp. The area increasingly became a military complex. Coldwater Spring continued to supply fresh water to Fort Snelling. The fort was to be sold in the 1850s, but then the Civil War started. As such, it became a much-needed outpost. Around the same time, the U.S. military began fighting wars against the Plains Indians. Fort Snelling became the headquarters for those wars. New buildings were constructed, and it continued to be a very important place during the Spanish-American War, World War I, and World War II. Fort Snelling continued as an active military base up until 1946. Coldwater Spring was described as a park, and at one point, it was thought that the Historical Society would take it over. In the 1950s, the federal government decided to use that property to build the Bureau of Mines campus. they preserved the spring but dramatically reduced access by the general public who might want to walk or use the spring. There have been some reports stating that Coldwater Spring was used as a supply of fresh water when the city of Minneapolis suffered a water shortage in the 1970s. In 1994, the Bureau of Mines campus was officially shuttered, and the building sat vacant. In 1998, the Minnesota Department of Transportation revealed their plans to reroute Highway 55. Coldwater Springs was thrust into the spotlight.
The state laws that protect it now are implemented because of the work we did, not to gain anything other than to protect what was already there. What were we going to gain from this, you know, other than to have this sacred site continue to flow water, because they were going to dynamite the fissures above that to put a runoff pond for their stupid road. So, and I went to the Indian Affairs Council, and at that time they said, well, if they destroy the flow to the spring, we'll just run city water through there. Nobody will know.
In 2010, Coldwater Spring was officially transferred to the National Park Service. The buildings from the Bureau of Mines era were to be torn down, and the area was going to be restored and preserved as a park. In 2006, the National Park Service hired a consulting agency by the name of Two Pines Group to conduct a large-scale ethnographic study about the property. They wanted to find out more about its history before 1820 and Camp Coldwater. An important part of that study and analysis was to figure out whether Coldwater Spring was and still is a sacred site to the Dakota, worthy of protection under the guidelines defined on the National Register of Historic Places.
So we did a big study in ethnography that looked at the site as an ethnographic site, as a sacred site, and as a traditional cultural property. After we reviewed that data and looked at the documentation that supported this being a traditional cultural property, a property that had been used by a tribe, a specific people, for a length of time, for specific purposes, the documentation is not there to support it.
The study included an 1837 map, testimony by Dakota elders, and the consulting group's own historical research. They concluded that the site was indeed a traditional cultural property, or TCP, considered sacred by the Dakota and thus worthy of protection under the guidelines set aside by the National Register. The Park Service disagreed. This issue about Coldwater Spring being a sacred site has proven to be an inflammatory one.
That's the complication of this place, is that we're being told by some tribes it's significant. We're being told by some individuals it's significant and sacred. We're being told by others that it's not, and not to treat it that way. And what we're seeing is this is a tremendously divisive issue within the Dakota communities themselves. One we're not privileged to look behind the curtain at, and I don't want to.
After the U.S.-Dakota War of 1862, Dakota people suffered from the loss of their land. Many were exiled, never to return to Minnesota, the place they considered their homeland. As a result, many people like Jim Anderson spent a lot of time finding out who they were and reconnecting with their Dakota heritage and history. Another casualty of this war is a loss of culture, a loss of stories, as Bruce White and Jim Anderson explain.
So it wasn't until the construction of Highway 55 that, you know, some of the Dakota people started talking about how that was an important place. But they'll say, I mean, you talk to Dakota people and they'll say that they knew of the site and they recognized its importance. But to expect that Dakota people would talk about their sacred sites freely with non-Dakota is asking a lot, considering the history of how the Dakota were treated.
Well, we've been in institutions, you know. Until 1978, it was against federal law for us to practice our spirituality at all. And a lot of these places, because of those type of policies of the U.S. government to kill the Indian, save the child, they took us to boarding schools. My great-grandmother went to a boarding school, and the Indian and the culture were beat out of us. So we didn't know. But this is where our creation stories come from. That's exactly where the rivers come together. And if you look from the satellites, our people called this place, we were the center of the earth people. And if you look from the satellites, we call North America Turtle Island, and we're the exact center of Turtle Island right there where we are.
Native people also point out another factor to be considered when asking for documentation and talking about Native traditions. Practicing your ceremonies and Native religion was outlawed up until 1978 when the American Indian Religious Freedom Act was passed. Upper Sioux tribal member Yvonne Leith remembers traveling to relatives' homes where ceremonies were to be performed. People would be covering the windows so that no one would know what was going on. A drum, a pipe, and other objects were cautiously taken out.
One thing I want to always make clear to people who are telling the story about Coldwater Springs is that we did not get our right to practice our traditional ceremonies until passing of the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. I was raised also during a time when the church was very much influenced in our communities. We had no choice. We had to accept Christianity for our own survival. However, as a small child, and now I'm 73 years old, I can remember my parents and other relatives going, sneaking off to ceremonies late at night. We would be, I can remember the feeling of knowing there was, that we were trying to hide or something, because I was a small child. I can remember those feelings as we drove up into the hills.
Yvonne Leith says that Native people rely on oral traditions, not on written documents.
So yes, we're very much aware of that. And even though there may not be tangible proof of the sacredness of these areas, we have our oral history, our stories handed down through families, through the generations, to these places where we fasted, we prayed, and sought visions as part of our traditional ways.
Native people aren't the only ones saying that there is a clash between what they see are different worlds and ways of knowing history and information. One of these people is the Minnesota Historical Society's own Pat Emerson.
It isn't necessary to have what we would look at from a Western view as firm scientific data. We should be able to get beyond the bounds of our own thinking once in a while and understand the value of other forms of knowledge.
Okimakwe, yohayo. Okimakwe, yohayo. Indin wegi shiku. Yo-hi-ho, Indin-wai-ki-shi-ku, yo-hi-ho.
During the Highway 55 reroute, Sharon Day brought Minnesota Representative Karen Clark out to Coldwater Spring. After that encounter, Clark sponsored a bill that states that the flow of Coldwater Spring cannot be harmed or diminished in any way. Minnesota Department of Transportation wanted to build an interchange in that area. But after dye tests were performed, it was discovered that such an interchange would affect the flow of the spring, something that activists and environmentalists had said all along. Sharon Day is the director of the Indigenous Peoples Task Force. She performs water ceremonies using the pure water from Coldwater Spring. She also leads and participates in an annual water walk to raise awareness about the impact that pollution and mining have on the water. On April 12th of 2011, the anniversary of the Gulf oil spill, she walked every day for 47 days until she got to Lake Superior. On her walk, she thought about the water they had taken from the Gulf and from Coldwater Spring, along with Josephine Mendaman, a grandmother.
Josephine said, you know, like every step should be a prayer for the water. When we've been walking for about 3 days, Josephine said to me, I've had a revelation. I've had this recognition of we've orphaned this water, taken it from its home, you know, to take it to another place. And we have to care for it the way we would care for a child. And I remember like holding that pail one day. We were we had a little portage across an area that was like flooded. And as I was holding that that water in the pail on my lap, I felt like it was my child.
Coldwater Spring is protected by Minnesota law. And according to environmental activist Susu Jeffrey, that's good because it's the last natural spring we have in the metro area. Her website, Friends of Coldwater, tirelessly documents changes to the flow, the environment surrounding the spring, and more. She even holds full moon walks near the spring every month. She's been involved in water issues since the 1970s.
So they cut down all the trees around Coldwater Springhouse and Reservoir. However, it's in the airport flight safety zone A, where no new structures or trees may be planted. Period. That's it. So I guess we're going to have a silent spring at Coldwater because all the trees are gone. Even the stumps have been ground down. It's also an erosion problem because this is really thin soil. We're just at the very top of the Great Mississippi Bluff. The reality is this land has been here for almost time immemorial. The top of this bluff was laid down, I think it was 438 million years ago. I mean, we're talking about eons, and in one fell swoop, they took out all the trees. This is unfortunate planning, and the shame of it is that the people who are planning this park are not educated in land planning or park planning. They're historians, they're urban planners, they're nice people, they care, but what's happened is devastating. Coldwater, or Minneawaseni, which Minnewater, Minneaway Spring, Snee in this case, Coldwater Spring, is the last natural spring in Hennepin County. There's one other spring in Eden Prairie called, I think, the William Miller Spring, which comes out of a pipe on the downhill side of a road. This is it. This is our last spring. And this spring furnished water to Fort Snelling for a century, from 1820 to 1920. So it's beautiful, historic, important.
Coldwater Spring is set to open as a park in September of 2012. According to the National Park Service, the potential for it to attract over 100,000 visitors annually is a reality.
So we are going to provide access to everybody, everybody from the tribes that have declared it sacred. And we're going to protect that site because it's the core of what this place is. The water flowing to that reservoir is the essence of that place, and we will by all means protect it because we're the National Park Service and we protect places like this.
Everyone, despite differing opinions, believes that this place should be protected. According to some, there is no one way of knowing its history. How do we define what is a sacred place for one? Perhaps we don't. But another thing many have in common is the belief in sharing. Sharing the precious gift of the flow of water. For KFAI, I'm Allison Herrera.
Mini Culture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.